read his title.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Okay, so my name is Lev Rzymaski. I'm a graduate student at Princeton. My talk is about some recent progress in understanding the dissipation of turbulent cascade and collision of plasma. We know that many astrophysical systems are collisionless or weakly collisional, and they host a turbulent cascade. But outside of the solar system, we can't really observe kinetic scales of this cascade. And what we can observe is the emission coming from the systems, which is shaped by how the cascade is dissipated, by how much energy is available for electrons and what particle distributions are there. In the kind of conditional picture of the cascade, there is some large-scale energy injection mechanism, which is system-dependent, and then the energy gets transferred scale by scale in such a way that the energy flux is conserved until it reaches kinetic scales where it can be dissipated by various mechanisms and results in ion heating and electron heating. And if the cascade goes like that, ion heating happens first, so the energy partition is decided essentially at the ion scale. So this is the case if plasma beta is low. If plasma beta is large, however, the large-scale waves can actually be unstable to kinetic microinstabilities. It is a result of the conservation of the magnetic moment of particles. So if you have, for example, Schirra Lane wave, there is some magnetic field fluctuation, and because of that, there is some perpendicular temperature fluctuation. If it's large enough, larger than approximately 1 over beta, this wave becomes unstable, and this is shown here. So if positive pressure anisotropy is produced, mirror and ion cyclotron instabilities are excited. So here are two hybrid simulations of Schirra-Lane wave, and this one has lower amplitude, so it is stable, and this one has amplitude larger than the threshold, so it becomes unstable to these instabilities. And in the opposite regime, when pressure anisotropy is less than zero, there is a fire hose instability. So what these instabilities do, they transfer energy from the larger scale all the way to kinetic scales, even though the scales may be well separated. For example, in physical systems, there may be like 10 orders of magnitude between these two scales. And this can, in principle, change the way the cascade is dissipated. So my talk will be about some hybrid kinetic simulations of turbulence and understanding the way the cascade is dissipated with or and without the instabilities. So what hybrid kinetics does is it solves lots of equations for ions with the method of characteristics, which is the same way as to say that it's particle and cell. Electrons are assumed to be massless fluid. Because of that, the electron density is exactly equal to the ion density. And electric field is determined from the equation of motion for electrons. So we incorporated this method into the new code called Pegasus++, which is a hybrid code based on the algorithm of Pegasus and infrastructure of Fini++. And the main difference between Pegasus++ and Pegasus is the performance. And the performance of Pegasus++ can be order of magnitude larger, so we can do a much bigger simulation. Our typical simulation setup looks like this. So we have a three-dimensional triple periodic box. On the larger scales of the box, we have some time-correlated driving. And the amplitude of the driving is chosen in such a way as to have critically balanced fluctuations at the outer scale of the box. So if you have some k-parallel corresponding to the parallel dimensional box and k-perp, then the amplitude of driving is basically fixed. And this allows us to explore different regimes. For example, in low beta cases, we typically use aspect ratios of 6 to 8 to mimic the realistic aspect ratio of eddies close to Larmor scale. While at high beta, we want to look at the instability, so we want to have fluctuations with large amplitude, so we choose smaller aspect ratios. So I'll start with kind of the simplest case of plasma beta close to unity. This plot shows spectrum of magnetic field in blue and electric field in red. So you see something close to minus 3 Fs, which gets steeper as turbulence transitions from a Lane wave turbulence to kinetic Lane wave turbulence. We can actually show that the waves which we see are kinetic Allen waves by comparing magnetic field spectrum and density spectrum. So we have kinetic Allen wave turbulence in kinetic range. If we plot the slope of the spectrum as a function of k, we see steepening, which implies that there is a dissipation happening at the scales. And this is something which is similar is observed in solar wind, actually. So we have several diagnostics to look at this dissipation. One of them is to look at the scale-dependent heating rate. So for that, we filter electric field in the box according to its perpendicular wave number, and then we compute an average of E dot V, average over all the particles in the box, and also average over time. And as a result, we have curves like this. So this is perpendicular wave number. Red and blue are perpendicular heating rates for two simulations, and orange and green are parallel heating rates. There are some error bars which show how these quantities oscillate over time. So here, the average value is much larger than the oscillation. And what we can see is that heating peaks in sub-ion Larmor range, and the peak is kind of consistent with dotted vertical lines. So those lines are the values of the wave number where the frequency of kinetic Allen waves becomes comparable to ion cyclotron heating frequency. So we can determine the frequency by computing parallel wave number as a function of perpendicular wave number. And we see that in inertial range, parallel wave number follows approximately k perp to 2/3, which is consistent with Goldreich-Schuthar model. And then after k perp equal 1, it steepens and becomes k parallel becomes proportional to k perp. And because the frequency of kinetic Allen wave is proportional to the product of k parallel and k perp, we have omega proportional to k squared, and that allows for the frequencies to become large enough somewhere in kinetic range, even though they are log frequency here. And as a result, the heating peaks at these frequencies. Emphasizes even more, here I show the frequency spectrum in the box. So this is frequency spectrum in a frame moving with the plasma. And if the energy flux is conserved, you expect the frequency spectrum to be omega to the minus 2 power, independent of the nature of the waves. And we see that this is indeed the case in low frequency limit and high frequency limit, but there is a drop somewhere near cyclotron frequency. So the waves which have frequencies comparable to cyclotron frequency dissipate. So this is the main mechanism which operates in our simulations, but this is of course not the only mechanism. And so this is basically the same as what Greg showed in his talk, like field particle correlation, but instead of two-dimensional plane is one-dimensional cuts in parallel direction, perpendicular direction, and we see a bunch of stuff happening. So for example, for parallel heating, there is this orange line and green line, which are consistent with Landau damping. So we see some Landau damping, but it is rather small, it's less than 10%. We also see that perpendicular heating is mostly follows the distribution function in parallel direction, not in perpendicular. It preferentially heats high velocity particles. The heating changes its distribution function in an interesting way. These two images show a perpendicular distribution function where we see that perpendicular temperature in the tail increases, but the core gets flattened. This is consistent with prediction from stochastic heating, which is shown here. As for parallel distribution, we see these non-thermal tails, which are produced by pitch angle scattering from perpendicular distribution into parallel. And stochastic heating doesn't operate at late times because the core gets flattened, but we see it at the early times. So this is the heating rate as a function of velocity, perpendicular velocity at the early time. We see this huge bump, which corresponds to stochastic heating. We can compute energy diffusion coefficient from it and compare it with theoretical models, and it's in agreement with theoretical predictions from for stochastic heating. Stochastic heating is more efficient at low beta, so we now have some simulations of even low betas, and there is a poster, Silvio Cherry has poster for beta 1/9, and there are even more interesting things happening. For example, we can see reconnection of the edges, and also heating as a function of wave number has two peaks now. One peak corresponds to high frequency heating, the same as what I just described. There is another peak at k rho I equal 1, which is probably stochastic heating. There is a question mark here because it may also be because of reconnection. We see that this peak appears when we see the disruption of edges. So if you're interested in low beta, go check out the poster. I will move to high beta now. So in high beta, edges may become unstable to kinetic microinstabilities. You can see it here. So here I show the results of beta 16 simulation, and you can see that there was two edges which got disrupted because of mirror instability. And you can see a bunch of quasi-parallel fluctuations as well. So if I... Sorry? Yeah, this is density and this is magnetic field. So if I zoom in a bit, at the early times you see a pattern like this, which is mirror instability. A bit later time you see this quasi-parallel fluctuations. You can look at the polarization of these fluctuations, and they turn out to be left-hand circularly polarized waves. So those are produced by Einstein-Couderlin instability. And at quasi-steady state you see basically everything mixed together. And you can also look at the structure functions at this time. So at this particular time, you see structure in, so here is structure function in perpendicular direction, parallel direction, and you can see two bumps in both directions. So those are oblique mirror fluctuations. And a bit later time, you also see a second bump from Einstein-Couderlin stability. And in steady state, you just see parallel spectrum steeper than perpendicular step spectrum, which is what you expect. So the fluctuations produced by instabilities cause pressure and isotropy to saturate between the thresholds. So here I show how pressure and isotropy evolves as a function of time. So here it's pressure and isotropy is a function of beta, and here I plot different thresholds, and you can see that at first, it crosses the thresholds, all the fluctuations are produced, and then it saturates between two thresholds. And the final distribution function looks actually much more boring than in low beta case. We just have Maxwellians with some small non-Maxwellian features and temperatures comparable to one another. The spectra of the fluctuations are actually quite different from low beta case. Instead of having 5 hertz and then something steeper, what we see is 5 hertz in inertial range, but then kinetic spectrum is shown in red gets steeper, while magnetic spectrum gets shallower. This is a result of some non-zero pressure and isotropy, which causes some viscous stress, which steepens the velocity spectrum. And the magnetic spectrum becomes shallower, which is similar to what is observed in MHD simulations of subviscous cascade, where the magnetic field fluctuations produced by instabilities get affected by viscous scale velocity and produce k to the minus one spectrum. Okay, even though the spectrum looks quite different, the ion heating actually looks the same. So here are the same diagnostics, heating as a function of wave number, for beta 16 and beta 4 simulation, and this is for comparison the previous plot. So they actually look pretty much the same. And the fraction of the cascade dissipated by ions also is pretty constant. It's roughly 75%. And most of the energization is perpendicular, which is actually quite surprising because there are some gyrokinetic simulations which predict that at high beta, most of the cascade should be dissipated by Landau damping. And Landau damping contribution is still quite small in our high beta simulations. So somehow the fluctuations produced by instabilities suppress the Landau damping. So even though the heating looks pretty much the same to low beta stuff, it's actually not trivial. Okay, I'm out of time, so put my conclusions here. So ion heating and turbulence is primarily caused by field particle interactions with high frequency waves. Ion energization is mostly perpendicular. At low beta, the distribution functions develop some flattened cores in perpendicular direction and some non-thermal tails in parallel. Iron heating is responsible for 80% of the cascade dissipation. At high beta inertial range, Alvin waves become unstable to instabilities, and fluctuations produced by these instabilities introduce an effective collisionality. Pressure and isotropy is bound between stability thresholds, and on average, it's quite small. And we have some predictions for spectra, which could be, in principle, tested in solar wind. And the final conclusion is that energy is a J-stream, and high beta and low beta is quite similar. Okay, thank you.
Questions? I'll let Alvin in the back.
Okay.
You should go first.
I go first. Okay, so just a question about the scattering rate in this condition. Did you estimate the scattering rate and compare it with the expected Coulomb collisions?
Well, Coulomb collisions are very ineffective here. So here I can, for example, estimate the mean free path of ions, and it turns out to be something like 100 Larmor radii.
So you're doing a hybrid code, and you don't have electron inertia in your Ohm's law, no electron kinetics. How certain are you that electron physics wouldn't change your energy apportionment numbers?
I'm certain at low beta, because the way the energy gets transferred. If beta is large enough and you can somehow excite electron scale instabilities, then you may have something different. But we cannot test it with current computing capabilities.
Hi. Interesting talk. I was just wondering, sort of more on the coding side of things, if you know why Pegasus++ is so much faster than regular Pegasus, or if not, if you can refer me to a methods paper. The slide that you had on that.
There is no short answer about it, so we can talk later if you want. But there are like multiple changes which were made to make it faster. So it's not just one change which made it faster, it's multiple.
It wasn't just like vectorization or something?
Of course, yeah.
Hey, Liv. I have a question about your last point, kind of following up on Amitabha's question, which is, does that mean that the ion to electron temperature ratio doesn't depend on beta in your turbulence?
In this range, based on these simulations, the answer is yes. The answer is a bit different in lower beta. For example, in Silvio's poster, he sees a different energy partition. But in this range, it's similar.
So I want to follow up on Mitava's point. I did not understand your reply on your point one of your conclusion. If you're not doing the dynamics between the ion and the electron correctly, and yet your main ion heating is due to the high frequency, how do you know you're doing it right?
Well, it still happens close to ion scales. So it doesn't happen at electron scales.
But how do you know?
Because I can measure the heating rate as a function of wave number, and I see that heating rate peaks at wave number of like KROI close to like 3. So it's not close to electron scales.
But the fluctuation spectra in that range can be wrong because you're not doing the electrons.
I don't see why it would be wrong. So it's just a transition from Alvin waves to kinetic Alvin waves. If the cascade is local, right, so the energy is transferred locally.
So you showed the diagnostics of E dot V averages. How does this compare to the method that was suggested in the previous talk? So
the method which Greg suggests is suitable, for example, for spacecraft observations where you have single point measurement and you compute distribution function, take derivatives, compute all that. So we have access to much more information here. So I can just average over the whole box instead of using a single point.
Is there any more information that you'll get from that method? Could you have applied it here
And would you get any more insight or less?
In principle, it should give the same result, except that what I showed is like time averaged and spatially averaged. And if you only use one point, you can't do spatial average.
More questions? John.
So if you calculate the scattering frequency from, say, the parallel wave number spectrum of waves in the around the ion gyroscope, does it match the measured collision frequency? So is it consistent that all of the particle scattering that's bringing you between the to the mirror and the Firehose threshold comes from small scale waves, or are there potentially something else going on?
Yeah, I'm not sure what wave numbers cause the scattering. So we don't.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, I'm not saying you have to measure that, but just are the numbers vaguely consistent?
I haven't estimated it.
Well, so you can measure the collision frequency from mu conservation, and then you can look at the spectrum of small-scale parallel fluctuations. Do the two match up?
You mean like mu is not the square?
Yeah.
So let me ask a question. So you didn't have explicit viscosity in the equations or method. It emerges dynamically from the kinetics. So, and it generates what effectively is a high Prandtl number?
Yes. So the viscosity scale is above the dispersion.
Right. I mean, yeah. Prandtl numbers in astrophysical fluids are always calculated using collision. Mm-hmm. But does this suggest that, in fact, the Prandtl numbers in real astrophysical plasmas may be dominated by these other wave particle interactions and other things, and you're more likely to, maybe work.
Yes. So here, what we see is essentially high Prandtl number turbulence. Mm-hmm. By high, I mean maybe less than 10, maybe around 10. So we can do like very high Prandtl.
Is there still a low Prandtl number regime left?
Not here, okay. Right?
Yeah. Yes. There's an effective name. Right. Yes.
Fair
enough. Right.
Well, you can kind of say that eta is determined by where the cascade is dissipated, right? The scale at which most of the dissipation happens, which is in sub-ion scale or sub-ion range. Well, the viscous break is before ion scales. So based on that, you can say that it's large Prandtl number.
Any other? All right, let's thank the speakers in the session. Lev in particular again. We have a 30-minute break. I encourage you to look at the posters. We'll start again at 4 o'clock.